Well, the tributes continue to come in for the former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, who has died after a short illness at the age of 84 and just months after his old adversary Gough Whitlam also died. His impact as a former statesman was felt across a range of issues, including refugee and asylum seeker policy, as you can read all about today. And it was this issue that prompted him to quit the Liberal Party about 5 years ago. But Malcolm Fraser also saw the importance of Australia looking outward, particularly to Asia, and we'll begin our tribute there. In a moment, I'll welcome Professor Ross Garnaut to the program, Vice Chancellor's Fellow and Professorial Research Fellow at the University of Melbourne, one of the longest consistent contributors to public policy in Australia, and certainly interested, as I think you know, in our whole region. But first, here is Malcolm Fraser talking to Saturday Extra at the time of the G20 meeting in Brisbane just last November about the importance of supporting a new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which it looks like Australia is set to do after a cabinet meeting on Monday.
If I was in charge of Australia's affairs today, which, you know, I've been out of Parliament over 30 years, I would certainly want to support that. I'd want Australia to put some capital into it. And I do not believe it would necessarily be a bad thing to have a competitor to the World Bank out there looking after these interests which the World Bank sometimes ignores. And I think that something like this, totally beyond the comprehension of the Europeans and the Americans, might be necessary to jolt Western leaders into a sense of reality. Because here there's another major difference between the, I think, highly idealistic years. They were my university years, my young years, growing up after the Second World War. Because then victors and vanquished knew that they had to do better. They knew that the world had nearly destroyed itself. Two major horrible wars within 20 years. And unless the world put itself in order, there'd be another. Now, the people who had lived through the Depression, lived through those world wars, were the ones governing affairs in Europe and around the world in the late 50s into the 60s. But such people don't exist today. Today's leaders believe that the good times, one way or another, are going to roll on almost regardless of what they do. So they don't have a sense of urgency. They don't have the same sense of commitment. They don't have the same imperative that the world just has to do better. Well, you know, today's imperatives, I think, are slightly different. There's no longer a Cold War, but global warming to me, I accept the science. I think that is an urgent reality. But where is it being tackled with the urgency that is really required? Unfortunately and sadly, certainly not in my own country. You know, there are always problems out there, but leaders need to be committed and they need to look not to their next election, but they need to ask, where are we all going to be 25, 30, 50 years ahead? And how do we make the world a better and a more secure, safer place? How do we help to diminish poverty and establish a fairer world? They're the questions that should be top of the agenda. And if a major economic gathering, which this is, can't address those issues, then we'll have to go to church or whatever.
A dreadful thought, Malcolm Fraser. It's amazing to think of that. Just last November. Now I'm going to welcome Ross Garnaut back to the program. Good morning, Ross.
Hello, Geraldine.
Can I get your response to some of those remarks there from Malcolm Fraser, particularly, well, I'll let you decide your response to them.
Oh, that was classic Malcolm. He did think about how the world fitted together and what we had to do to make it a safer place, a place where peace was more likely. He thought ahead a lot on those issues. My main personal contact with him on policy was over three issues that in their ways were of the kind he was raising in that interview. He was very interested personally very intelligently interested in the future of Papua New Guinea. Wasn't starry-eyed about it. He knew things could go dreadfully wrong. But he wanted to understand what was going on wanted Australia to be well-informed so that it could be guided by knowledge in the way it managed its relations with Papua New Guinea. And he used to seek out to a couple of us at the ANU who followed Papua New Guinea closely to make sure that that his view of policy on Papua New Guinea was grounded in reality of what was going on.
He continued to do that, did he?
No, I'm talking about as Prime Minister.
Oh, I see, as Prime Minister, pardon me.
Right through his time as Prime Minister, in a way that no other Australian Prime Minister has. Because he had a sense of how important it was that Papua New Guinea didn't go wrong and that Australia didn't let it go wrong. The second issue on which I had quite a lot to do with him was Australia's relations with Southeast Asia. Now, he did come under attack from leaders in Southeast Asia, famously Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, but others as well, for Australia's protectionist policies during the period of his prime ministership, protection for textiles and other products that were becoming important in exports of Southeast Asia was rising. Now, I personally thought that was a mistake at the time, he was implementing policies that were consistent with his own doubts about free markets in those areas, and also implementing policies that he thought were deeply rooted in the preferences of the Australian community. But he didn't pursue those policies in an ignorant way. And on his initiative, he funded the setting up of what we call the Australia-ASEAN Economic Relations Research Project, in which networks of economists were extending through all of the Southeast Asian countries were established to study these issues. Now, it took time, but over time, these networks were very important in the informing of the Australian polity about the effects of protection and were important in the ultimate dismantling of Australian protection, so that his own instincts were protectionist, but he was also of a mind that wanted policy to be informed by understanding of the issues and was a supporter of research. The third area in which I was personally closely associated with his work was on Asia-Pacific economic cooperation. And there it was his initiative with the Japanese Prime Minister Ohira that led to the first Pacific Community Seminar at the ANU that was the precursor to the Pacific Economic Cooperation Council and eventually to APEC. And Malcolm personally had a view that that governments were not only governments, businesses, scholars of the Asia-Pacific region being closely in touch with each other, thinking through the issues of the future was going to be very important to getting the most out of economic opportunity, but also for peace and stability in the region. So my personal contact with him underlines the perspectives that he was putting to you several decades later.
Mm. And I think you also spoke to him a couple of months ago, Ross, about what he thought was wrong with politics today, partly related to what he called the corruption of political donations.
Yes, that was my last conversation with him. I used to have a chat with him every now and again, and the last one was a few months ago. He began that conversation, but I hadn't seen him since his book had come out. And he began that conversation by asking whether I thought he'd gone mad on foreign policy. I assured him not mad, but there were things to
discuss.
This was
about the relationship with the US.
Yes, and we had a good chat about that. But most of the conversation ended up being about Australian political culture. And he, like many Australians, certainly like me, was worried that that the influence of money in the policy-making process had got out of hand. And he was comparing the political culture of the Liberal Party that he entered when he became member for one and in the 50s with that today. He thought that the then Liberal Party's very strong insistence on separation of political leaders from political donations reflected the personal values of Menzies, and he continued to think they were appropriate right through his life. For example, the very clear rule in his electorate was that he was not allowed to know who had donated money to his campaign in Wannon. And he contrasted that situation with the situation today, where not only do you know, but people don't get to sit next to you at dinner unless you've given a large donation. And he thought that the chances of getting good policy in the public interest out of the modern political culture, where money was so influential in access and in shaping of policy, was very unlikely, thought that we needed to restore some of those aspects of political culture from Menzies' days.
Ross Garnaut, I was going to ask you about Lee Kuan Yew, but I can't. I have the news hard on my heels. So thank you very, very much indeed for joining us today.
Okay, Geraldine, good to talk to you. And let's think of Malcolm, who was a fine man.
Yes, indeed. I just noticed Cameron Stewart writing in the Australian Today. Australia has lost its most enigmatic Prime Minister, a man who almost all Australians had admired at some stage in their lives as his politics slid from right to left with age. That's quite an epitaph, really. And do be aware also of another giant, Lee Kuan Yew, in critical condition in Asia. Well, the tributes continue to come in for the former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, who has died after a short illness at the age of 84 and just months after his old adversary Gough Whitlam also died. His impact as a former statesman was felt across a range of issues, including refugee and asylum seeker policy, as you can read all about today. And it was this issue that prompted him to quit the Liberal Party about 5 years ago. But Malcolm Fraser also saw the importance of Australia looking outward, particularly to Asia, and we'll begin our tribute there. In a moment, I'll welcome Professor Ross Garnaut to the program, Vice Chancellor's Fellow and Professorial Research Fellow at the University of Melbourne, one of the longest consistent contributors to public policy in Australia, and certainly interested, as I think you know, in our whole region. But first, here is Malcolm Fraser talking to Saturday Extra at the time of the G20 meeting in Brisbane just last November about the importance of supporting a new Asian infrastructure investment bank, which it looks like Australia is set to do after a cabinet meeting on Monday.
If I was in charge of Australia's affairs today, which, you know, I've been out of parliament over 30 years, I would certainly want to support that. I'd want Australia to put some capital into it. And I do not believe it would necessarily be a bad thing to have a competitor to the World Bank out there looking after these interests, which the World Bank sometimes ignores. And I think that something like this, totally beyond the comprehension of the Europeans and the Americans, might be necessary to jolt Western leaders into a sense of reality. Because here there's another major difference between the, I think, highly idealistic years, they were my university years, my young years, growing up after the Second World War. Because then victors and vanquished knew that they had to do better. They knew that the world had nearly destroyed itself. Two major horrible wars within 20 years. And unless the world put itself in order, there'd be another. Now, the people who had lived through the Depression, lived through those world wars, were the ones governing affairs in Europe and around the world in the late 50s into the 60s. But such people don't exist today. Today's leaders believe that the good times, one way or another, are going to roll on almost regardless of what they do. So they don't have a sense of urgency. They don't have the same sense of commitment. They don't have the same imperative that the world just has to do better. Well, you know, today's imperatives, I think, are slightly different. There's no longer a Cold War, but global warming, to me, I accept the science. I think that is an urgent reality. But where is it being tackled with the urgency that is really required? Unfortunately and sadly, certainly not in my own country. You know, there are always problems out there, but leaders need to be committed and they need to look not to their next election, but they need to ask, where are we all going to be 25, 30, 50 years ahead? And how do we make the world a better and a more secure, safer place? How do we help to diminish poverty and establish a fairer world? They're the questions that should be top of the agenda. And if a major economic gathering, which this is, can't address those issues, then we'll have to go to church or whatever.
A dreadful thought, Malcolm Fraser. It's amazing to think of that just last November. Now I'm going to welcome Ross Garnaut back to the program. Good morning, Ross.
Hello, Geraldine.
Can I get your response to some of those remarks there from Malcolm Fraser, particularly, well, I'll let you decide your response to them.
Oh, that was classic Malcolm. He did think about how the world fitted together and what we had to do to make it a safer place, a place where peace was more likely. And he thought ahead a lot on those issues. My main personal contact with him on policy was over three issues that in their ways were of the kind he was raising in that interview. He was very interested personally, very intelligently interested in the future of Papua New Guinea. Wasn't starry-eyed about it. He knew things could go dreadfully wrong. But he wanted to understand what was going on and wanted Australia to be well-informed so that it could be guided by knowledge in the way it managed its relations with Papua New Guinea. And he used to seek out to a couple of us at the ANU who followed Papua New Guinea closely to make sure that that his view of policy on Papua New Guinea was grounded in reality of what was going on.
He continued to do that, did he?
No, I'm talking about as Prime Minister.
Oh, I see, as Prime Minister, pardon me.
Right through his time as Prime Minister, in a way that no other Australian Prime Minister has. Because he had a sense of how important it was that Papua New Guinea didn't go wrong and that Australia didn't let it go wrong. The second issue on which I had quite a lot to do with him was Australia's relations with Southeast Asia. Now, he did come under attack from leaders in Southeast Asia, famously Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, but others as well, for Australia's protectionist policies during the period of his prime ministership, protection for textiles and other products that were becoming important in exports of Southeast Asia was rising. Now, I personally thought that was a mistake at the time, but he was implementing policies that were consistent with his own doubts about free markets in those areas, and also implementing policies that he thought were deeply rooted in the preferences of the Australian community. But he didn't pursue those policies in an ignorant way. And on his initiative, He funded the setting up of what we call the Australia-ASEAN Economic Relations Research Project, in which networks of economists were extending through all of the Southeast Asian countries were established to study these issues. Now, it took time, but over time, these networks were very important in the informing of the Australian polity about the effects of protection, and were important in the ultimate dismantling of Australian protection. So that his own instincts were protectionist, but he was also of a mind that wanted policy to be informed by understanding of the issues, and was a supporter of research. The third area in which I was personally closely associated with his work was on Asia-Pacific economic cooperation, and there it was his initiative with the Japanese Prime Minister Ohira that led to the first Pacific Community Seminar at the ANU that was the precursor to the Pacific Economic Cooperation Council, and eventually to APEC. And Malcolm personally had a view that that governments were not only governments, businesses, scholars of the Asia-Pacific region, being closely in touch with each other, thinking through the issues of the future, was going to be very important to getting the most out of economic opportunity, but also for peace and stability in the region. So my personal contact with him underlines the perspectives that he was putting to you several decades later.
Mm. And I think you also spoke to him a couple of months ago, Ross, about what he thought was wrong with politics today, partly related to the, I think, what he called the corruption of political donations.
Yes, that was my last conversation with him. I used to have a chat with him every now and again, and the last one was a few months ago. He began that conversation, but I hadn't seen him since his book had come out. He began that conversation by asking whether I thought he'd gone mad on foreign policy. I assured him not mad, but there were things to discuss.
This was about the relationship with the US.
Yes, and we had a good chat about that. But most of the conversation ended up being about Australian political culture. And he, like many Australians, certainly like me, was worried that that the influence of money in the policy-making process had got out of hand. And he was comparing the political culture of the Liberal Party that he entered when he became member for one and in the 50s with that today. He thought that the then Liberal Party's very strong insistence on separation of political leaders from political donations reflected the personal values of Menzies, and he continued to think they were appropriate right through his life. For example, the very clear rule in his electorate was that he was not allowed to know who had donated money to his campaign in Wannon. And he contrasted that situation with the situation today, where not only do you know, but but people don't get to sit next to you at dinner unless you've given a large donation. And he thought that the chances of getting good policy in the public interest out of the modern political culture, where money was so influential in access and in shaping of policy, was very unlikely, and thought that we needed to restore some of those aspects of political culture from Menzies' days.
Ross Garnaut, I was going to ask you about Lee Kuan Yew, but I can't. I have the news hard on my heels. So thank you very, very much indeed for joining us today.
Okay, Geraldine, good to talk to you. And let's think of Malcolm, who was a fine man.
Yes, indeed. I just noticed Cameron Stewart writing in the Australia Today. Australia has lost its most enigmatic Prime Minister, a man who almost all Australians had admired at some stage in their lives as his politics slid from right to left with age. That's quite an epitaph, really. And do be aware also of another giant, Lee Kuan Yew, in critical condition in Asia.